seems like every holiday around here has a big storm named after it. You have the Hanukkah Eve storm in 2006, the Columbus Day storm 1962. There was, I remember, the Inauguration Day storm in the 90s. And it was Thanksgiving Day 1983, 35 years ago, when the Turkey Day storm struck, wreaking havoc on electric ovens throughout Western Washington. Historian Felix Bunnell is here to remind us of that, brought to us by the King County Library System.
Yeah, Turkey Day storm, so legendary around here for people who were living in the Puget Sound area back in November 1983. For my family on Rose Hill in Kirkland, my mother had just taken the giant turkey out of our battered old Kenmore oven when the lights conked out in the early afternoon, so we were okay. I reached out to my favorite go-to guy for weather history, and that's Ted Beener. Ted retired from the National Weather Service last year, but he's still active in the emergency preparedness community, and he's still passionate about the weather, as he has been since he was a child, and was inspired by that Columbus Day storm. I caught up with Ted in Lake Forest Park and asked him to tell me what happened on November 24th, 1983.
Well, simply put, we had a windstorm come through Western Washington, and it knocked down a lot of trees and knocked out power to a pretty widespread part of Western Washington. Traffic signals were out, trees were down, and all those kinds of things. And I'm listening on radio while trying to get through all this to get down to the Rose City. And all kinds of people have turkeys that are half-cooked. And I can't imagine what they tried to do to resolve this problem, but clearly that was an issue. And that's why everybody remembers the Turkey Day storm of 1983.
Yeah, and something like 270,000 customers were without electricity during the peak of the outages, and there's no exact numbers on the no exact figures on the numbers of half-cooked turkeys, of course. Do you remember this storm, Dave? Were you?
I do, because we had a family that we spent Thanksgiving with, and their power went out, and they so they brought the half-cooked turkey over to our house. We still had power, and so we just finished up there.
So you did a transfer. You moved it from
we
one.
Did.
Okay, awesome.
Now,
thanks to our good friend Casey McNerthney over at Cairo TV, we have some vintage news reports from the Turkey Day storm. This is Anita Williamson.
Mother Nature took everyone by surprise today. Winds gusting to 75 miles per hour whipped through the area, and by late this morning, emergency calls had already mounted. Trees were blown down in several areas, forcing drivers to take alternate routes. Power lines snapped, and roofs threatened to give way. The Evergreen Point Bridge took a turn for the worse. It was finally shut down around noon. West Seattle saw the most action. The shore along Beach Drive looked like Santa Monica at its worst. But residents came out to witness the event firsthand.
I'm just watching the waves go over the houses down there.
For thousands, the holiday meal was over a camp stove. But it was Mother Nature's way of making sure Thanksgiving 1983 wasn't just another day.
Speaking of the bridge, it was over Thanksgiving Day holiday, the Mercer-on-Tholing Bridge went down.
Exactly. Yeah, November is a rough month, and that was one of Ted Beener's points, because, you know, we were joking about the holidays attracting bad weather, and maybe it's just because there's so many holidays this time of year, but Ted Beener says it's really all about November.
November is our wettest month of the year, even though you wouldn't know that this year. Clearly, we're way behind normal for precipitation this month. But this tends to be our most active storm season as we kick out of October and into November. It's our number one month for floods. We've had a number of windstorm events during this time of year. We've also had some snow events that get started. You might remember November of 1985, we had a nice cold weather outbreak and snow before Thanksgiving that year. I remember I had 8 inches in my backyard on Thanksgiving Day.
Yeah, so November can be brutal. Ted says there were big floods in 1986 and 1990 when the bridge sank, and then in November of 1995. But so what do we do with this knowledge to know that on any given holiday, a big storm can take our Kenmore ranges out mid-turkey? I asked the only people qualified to answer, and that's the Butterball Turkey Talk Line. A 19-year veteran there named Sue Smith gave me the fairly unsurprising answer of move the turkey from the oven to an outdoor grill, which I guess is a great idea. But and a lot of people tried to do that back in 1983, and I don't know how successful they were. I'd love to hear from people who were able to overcome this power failure if they reach out to us on the Online Trading Academy text line at 98973, if you were able to successfully make that swap. I think making the swap midway is probably pretty tricky and possibly even dangerous. I asked Sue at Butterball, if you do make the swap, how do you know when it's done cooking?
What is really important on that day, it's your best friend, is your meat thermometer. You really need to have one on hand so you know when your turkey is done, and to make sure it does get up to appropriate temperatures quick enough. So 180 in the thigh, 170 in the breasts. But to answer your question, yeah, meat thermometer is really your best way.
So it's all about thermometers, this story, Dave. It's weather and it's meat thermometers.
So that's part of your storm prep is to have your meat thermometer handy.
Yeah, because you never know. We could have a Christmas storm. It's not going to happen this year, but we could have a storm next Thanksgiving. You never know. And she also said you could use your Alexa in a power failure as long as it was charged up. But I thought about that at the time. I didn't think about it later. I thought, wait a minute. If your Wi-Fi is down, your power's out, how's your Alexa going to work?
Yeah. The Alexa, I don't think Alexa has a battery in it.
I think you can. You might be able to hook it up. You can do a Bluetooth thing with your phone, but I don't think that's going to work. I think write it down or get a book or something.
Well, I've got my generators hooked up to the computer circuit in the house, so we can keep the computer up. But I don't know what, you know, if you're communicating with somebody else whose computer is down, I don't know what good that is. I assume let's see. Well, Amazon would have a lot of backup power, right? They got all those servers. You got to have backup power.
So you have a generator at your house?
Yeah.
Could you run your electric oven on your generator?
No. If it was a real emergency, I'd fire up the wood stove, let it go down to coals, and then put the turkey on the tray inside the wood stove. I've cooked hamburgers that way in a pinch. Yeah.
Anyway, well, it's something you just have to be used to here in November in the Northwest.
That's true. Felix Bunnell brought to us by the King County Library System. On the topic of a Saudi journalist murdered, dismembered, and possibly dissolved, the president says,
it's a shame, but it's... it is what it is.
The Secretary of State says.
It's a mean, nasty world out there. The Middle East in particular.
No denying that. So let's go to the United Nations and CBS Foreign Affairs analyst Pamela Falk. Pamela, I posted kind of a snarky remark about this on my Twitter feed. And immediately people said, look, this is hardly the first brutal dictatorship that America has gotten in bed with. So put this in perspective for us. Is this out of the norm?
It is out of the norm. Of course, the United States has had relationships with dictatorships all through the 1970s in Latin America, as well as in other places of the world. The issue is, and I'm sorry, to just add to that point, the North Koreans are one of the toughest relationships in the world that the United States is trying to resolve and get them off the nuclear countdown, but the U.S. isn't an ally. Now, here, it is quite different because the United States is not saying they're putting up with Saudi Arabia. They're saying they are, in fact, an allied and a valued ally. And part of the issue is, number one, the money. The money, there have been many fact checks about this. The $450 billion that President Trump has talked about is really quite less. These are commitments. State Department itself says it hasn't come through. It's something more like $16 billion in goods, U.S. exported. And the Saudis really aren't going to be going anywhere with all these sales. They're not going to be buying Russian equipment. So on the finances, not that that's the only issue, it's really not the case. Now, otherwise, part of the issue here is also, what are American values? The brutality of this murder makes it different from other examples of domestic brutality or human rights violations in other countries. This was savage, and it was with a U.S. resident and a journalist, and it goes to a lot of American core values. And so I think there's a reason that it's not just a Democratic Party criticism. It's not just critics of Trump who are saying it. It's now not only the GOP, but Senator Bob Corker, who's been the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Senate, now he is leaving, but he wrote on his Twitter feed, just to make you feel better, Dave, I never thought I'd see the day a White House would moonlight as a public relations firm for the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, but we did support the Shah of Iran. We supported Saddam Hussein at one point, and so... I mean, and we
and even
didn't
Gaddafi
have the kind
of, at one point.
Well, right. And they were brutal murderers. We didn't have a graphic description as we do in this case, of course, but we did support them.
No, I think the difference is, number one, I think this is going to be a case study of information flows. I mean, the internet has fundamentally changed what we know. I mean, we now have an audio of the murder. This is an American, American resident, writer for an American news organization. And I think that does change things. So the U.S. has invaded countries victories over Americans being taken captive. This is not only domestic. And number two, the savagery of the actual murder and the fact that we were able to find out about it with all the lies and dissembling of the Saudis. He went out the back. He was in a fist fight. He's in the Muslim Brotherhood. All of that has really put a face on the relationship. And the United States has never gone for you can do better in an economic relationship coldly over a human rights really criminal.
Let me ask you this, Pamela.
That's why they're going for the Global Magnitsky Act.
Could this also be used in a way as some kind of leverage to get the Saudis to ease up on this war in Yemen, which has become a humanitarian catastrophe of the highest order?
Yes. Now, part of that issue is in Yemen, half of the population is on the brink of famine. It is not heading for a catastrophe. It already is a catastrophe. And this is a complicated battle that has Iran-backed Houthi rebels, the U.S.-backed Saudi coalition fighting them, but the kind of air attacks by the Saudi coalition has prompted the Trump administration to at least not allow the Saudis to refuel en route to that battle, and an attempt to try to cut off some of the arms sales, at least in the U.S. Senate proposals, so that this battle can't be fought. And what we're seeing right here at the U.N. is that the Brits, the U.K., introduced a resolution to try to come up with a ceasefire, and it's Saudi, with ally Kuwait, trying to block it. So this is one of the areas where the United Nations actually could do something. The world powers, United States is behind it, and as France and Russia and China don't seem to be presenting any major obstruction. And then the Saudi Arabia has been actively lobbying against it because they don't want to give anything up in order to make peace. And this is a time when 84,000 children may have died, is what they came out with yesterday. The UN says hundreds of thousands of people are on the brink of famine, and people are dying of starvation. So it's one of the worst humanitarian crises we've ever seen, and it's playing out in real time, and the Saudis are blocking any kind of resolution of it.
Pamela Falk at the UN. Pamela, thank you very much.
Absolutely, Dave. Good talking to you.
To the issue of red flag laws. Washington State was among the first to have what are called extreme risk protection orders that allow courts to temporarily suspend a person's gun rights if they show signs of being a danger to themselves or others. And Kyra's Hannah Scott has been following this. Some people are now pushing for those laws to go even further and apply to kids as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Because our state was one of the first five states in the country to have these extreme risk protection orders, or ERPOs as they're called. They've been law here since 2016. Eight more states, by the way, have passed these laws in the wake of the Parkland school shooting, and another four are considering them right now. The laws vary by state as far as who can petition the court for the civil orders. In our state, it's police and family members of people who exhibit signs of dangerous behavior, suicidal thoughts, and focusing in on weapons of some sort. But the law is silent here on whether minors can be the subject of an ERPO. But now there's an effort to change that. For the past several months, a task force made up of police, mental health experts, school shooting survivors, the ACLU, and others has been meeting to come up with strategies to prevent mass shootings in our state, with a special focus on schools. And they just recently released a list of 25 recommendations, including clarifying our state law to make it clear that ERPOs can apply to minors.
We've had that issue come up multiple times, and we've been asked about it around the state from other law enforcement agencies that are kind of struggling with the same issue. And to date, I don't know of any that have been filed yet against juveniles, but we have one particular case where we're making that recommendation to law enforcement right now.
Well, if you're a juvenile, you can't have a gun anyway.
So, and I'll explain. Yeah. So here's why this is important. That's Prosecutor Kimberly Wyatt, by the way. She is with King County's Regional Domestic Violence Firearms Unit, which focuses in, helps other agencies throughout the state go ahead and petition for these ERPOs. Now, Wyatt says they're working on one right now with a school resource officer at a school where a kid is charged with a crime requiring he not have access to weapons.
Yeah.
But they need to make sure his dad doesn't have access. That's where the ERPO comes in.
Against the juvenile, because the father has access to firearms in the home, and we, in the father is not being cooperative with law enforcement to confirm that the firearms are out of the home. So that's the concern, is law enforcement has made numerous attempts to verify where the firearms are, and the father has declined to give information so that law enforcement can follow up.
So the ERPO would be served on the kid, and it's not about taking away the dad's gun rights.
We're trying to say that, you know, dad lawfully can possess those guns, and we would hope that most parents, and I think they, the most that law enforcement have encountered, have, you know, given law enforcement reassurances where the firearms are. But in this particular case, the father has declined to give any of those reassurances. So we would say that the juvenile cannot be in that home with access to firearms. If dad wants to keep the firearms in the home or not shared the information, you know, that puts them in a difficult position, too.
So the dad has to choose between his guns and his kid.
That would be the case if he was served with the ERPO. If he doesn't want to tell the investigators where those weapons are, prove that they're not in the house, then the kid can't be there.
Wow. So that's harsh. So, and he doesn't even, so what they want is some guarantee that those weapons are locked up and that the kid doesn't know how to get access to them, right?
Absolutely. It's the same as when an ERPO is issued for an adult, right? They temporarily suspend your rights for gun rights for 14 days, and then a judge can give it up to a year. And then they take those guns, they put them in a lockbox somewhere, and you get them back after that time if you can, you know, prove everything is better. It would be the same in this case. So you got to pick between the kid or the guns, essentially. She says there's also been other cases, though, where an 18-year-old kid at school was found to have a gun. Now, this involves a student in Seattle who police came to talk to about a drug issue, and the student allowed the police to search his bag.
And when law enforcement and the school officials searched it, they found a loaded gun, and I believe it was actually stolen, but it was a loaded gun with the safety off in the front pouch of the backpack. And although, and this was a case where the student didn't make any threats of any kind to anybody else, but law enforcement and ourselves were concerned enough that this was somebody who was negligent in bringing that firearm to school, and the court issued the extreme risk protection order both at the emergency phase and then also at the full hearing.
So we now have a series of cases where this has potentially stopped a disaster.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether, again, in that particular case, it was an 18-year-old, so he could have been served with the ERPO already, but definitely in the other case. And it's something that there's a big effort to try to figure out what we can do to prevent mass shootings everywhere, but again, specifically in schools. That task force came out with its initial recommendations that also include things like more funding for mental health statewide, school resource officers at every school, training, a campaign to teach kids starting in kindergarten all the way through high school to, if they see something, say something, right. Teach them how to recognize certain behaviors that could be a concern. And then, you know, there's checks and balances to that. Also, active shooter drills at every school, things of that nature.
So will the legislature be expanding then this law?
They are definitely taking it up. And they just had this work session a week or so ago, and there was these that don't involve guns specifically, just expansion of this existing law of ERPOs is definitely something that there was interest in. And I expect that we'll see something in that regard as when the legislative session starts. Other things, by the way, that they want to look at for ERPOs at the law enforcement level is, can they apply to hate crimes? You know, that's something that she was talking to me about. They're investigating.
In other words, if somebody's convicted of a hate crime, can they disarm you for that too?
For hate speech specifically.
Hate speech, so like a Twitter
post
get you disarmed?
That, again, it's early in those discussions.
I was just trolling.
And that's something they started talking about after what happened in Pittsburgh recently with the 11 people killed. So they're looking at ways that they can be used. Other states that have ERPO laws, they allow other than family members and police to be involved. They also allow your therapist to petition for an ERPO if you've got some behavior there. Here in our state, you can't do that, but your therapist, your boss, your workplace, your school can go to this King County Domestic Firearms Unit and ask some questions, and they can do it for you, essentially, if you have an issue.
Just to be clear about the previous case we were talking about with the guns and the kid, So under the law as it's written, if they have any concern that your underage child, who can't legally have access to a gun anyway, could get access to a gun in the home, they can right now take that kid out of the home if you refuse to cooperate?
No, that's why we need that change, because our state law is silent on the juvenile, because the child has to be served with the ERPO.
Okay, that's the change that they're looking to.
Yes.
Does that have any support? That sounds like that might cross a line for a lot of people.
So far, I haven't heard anybody speak against it, but it's a small group we're talking about.
Because
you're going to
the gun owner himself, who has not misused the gun.
Yep.
Right. Your concern is over the kid who might misuse a gun if he got it. But you're telling the gun owner, either you prove to us you're storing this gun in a way that we're comfortable with,
yeah,
or we're going to take your child.
Well, and I don't think that they're going to put him in foster care. The kid has to go live with another relative, go stay with a friend. He can't be in the house. That's the idea.
Can't be in the house.
Let's look at the Marysville Pilchuck High School, right? That shooting was a kid who got a gun from his dad who was not supposed to have
them.
You have to be able – it's all about the access. That's what the ERPO does. It removes the access to weapons. So if you can serve a kid with an ERPO, that civil order makes it so that kid can't have access, which means can't be in any home where there is a weapon.
Wow. Okay. Hannah Scott, thank you.
You bet.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is from 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill. Tell us about the NCAA mustache rule, which I did not know existed.
It's not a mustache rule.
What is it?
It is a marketing rule. It's a requirement that prohibits athletes from having their likenesses sold or marketed by outside parties. So a quarterback, say, for a local college, mm-hmm. and if you are a nearby town and you decide to have, I don't know, what do you call it, Gardner Minshew days, and hand out mustaches, that's a potential violation because you're using his likeness to market your event.
And that's what happened in Colfax. The Chamber of Commerce in Colfax, Washington, decided it'd be a good idea to pay tribute to Washington State quarterback Gardner Minshew, who has a mustache, and so they held Gardner Minshew Days, and it used like a logo?
It had a mustache. They were giving out mustaches because he's known for having what I like to call a snot mop or lip holstery, a cookie duster. Yeah.
And a lot of people wear them at the games.
Correct.
At Pullman.
And when they sell them at Washington State, they are not.
Will they sell them?
Oh yeah, for $2. They sold out at the game.
Well,
everybody's
why
wearing.
Why is that allowed?
There's no mention of Gardner Minshew on the mustaches.
I see.
I think they've got a picture of Uncle Rico maybe, because of the rules about how you can market that you can't use an athlete's likeness.
So the problem with Colfax is not the mustache; it's using the name.
It's Gardner Minshew. You cannot use his name to market things.
Why does this rule exist?
Because the NCAA is an antiquated and oppressive institution.
No, because it's trying to maintain purity in college sports.
It is under the guise of amateurism, which has long ago left the building. When you consider the salaries that the people making and enforcing these rules draw from college athletics.
These guys make, the NCAA officials make money?
Oh, yeah.
Big money?
Yes. Yes, they
like
make hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah. Well, how much do you think Chris Peterson makes? $4 million.
Well, he's a coach, though.
Yeah. Well, how about...
You expect that your highest paid state employees are going to be your football coaches. It wouldn't be natural.
Which is always the most misleading thing to say, because they basically draw money from the athletics fund.
It's not coming from the taxpayers.
Mark Emmert, who runs the NCAA... Mark Emmert, who runs the NCAA, he's got to make $500,000. He probably makes more. He probably makes seven figures.
Well, he's running a major corporation.
No, but it's a major corporation that exists off of the amateur labor. Yeah. The people that actually generate the money, the people that we watch.
In every business, they try to keep labor costs low so that you can make money.
Is there any other business that prohibits the employees from being paid?
Well, but they are paid in terms of getting a full ride scholarship. Right?
They're paid in essentially iTunes certificates.
Well,
you can use them to redeem at this very specific
store.
They
go into this knowing exactly what the rules of the game
are. What's the option for an 18-year-old who wants to be an NFL player? What career path does he have?
well, let the NFL just draft 18-year-olds like baseball.
It's against the rules. It's the NFL rules are set up that you cannot draft a player until he's 3 years removed from his high school graduation.
So you get to squeeze as much money you want out of these college athletes before they're even able to make a dime.
And if a nearby town wants to have a fun little festival honoring the quarterback, you can't do it because the NCAA is terrified that you might make 2 cents off of it.
Gross.
Hmm. Well, we've discussed this before, and all you can do is just decide you're going to actually do the honest thing and turn these into farm teams and pay them.
Correct. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is for the NCAA to apply some common sense to it and to look at what exactly is happening here and not try to govern it based on some 1960s outmoded ideal of amateurism,
right, but
recognize
that,
what's happening.
But then what happens then? So you let this pass, and pretty soon, you know, Gardner Minshew becomes a wealthy student, and everybody else is just an also-ran. How does that help the team?
That happens now. There are rich kids at University of Washington that had their dads buy them cars. There's not any sort of equality on campus. Why can't he sell his likeness?
Hmm.
There's nothing preventing any other. If there is a stellar singer that's up there
that's
who signed a recording contract, there's no rule prohibiting. Nope, you're in college.
That's right.
You have to be an amateur.
And if a college guy in a dorm room starts a big software company, there's no rule against that.
Yeah, you can even drop out and be still heralded and buy and donate millions of dollars on the back end. But if you're a football player, you got to play there 3 years and you got to follow our rules. And darn it, nobody's going to make money off your likeness except us.
All right, you win. So how do we get this changed?
I don't know.
Players ever talked about a strike?
Yeah, they've never talked about. Yeah,
they had
a couple that are unionized.
Yeah.
I believe Northwestern is actually a union. You had a player sue a video game maker over the player's likenesses, which for a long time people were talking, oh, this is going to bring down the NCAA, and it didn't. It just stopped them from making what I thought was a great video game.
Yeah,
so
me
now,
too.
Yeah, so now we get hosed because we don't have NCAA football anymore.
God.
That was really
love
fun.
Love that game. I love that game.
Instead, we took it in the shorts from the Ed O'Bannon. By my measure, I'm the only one that lost.
I lost too on that. I love that game.
One question. If they start paying the athletes, would that affect ticket prices?
Maybe. You know what it would profoundly affect? It would profoundly affect scholarship opportunities for women.
Why?
Because women are not, for the most part, revenue sports. And if you turned over college sports and made it much more of a straight capitalist endeavor, you would see, even now, I would argue that do women have the same opportunities for scholarships in sports? Not really, because there's an 85 scholarship.
So what you're
football.
Saying is the unpaid men are subsidizing the women.
Overall, in an athletic department, yes. The unpaid men are subsidizing.
That's how it should be.
Well, but the unpaid men are also subsidizing bureaucrats. And they're subsidizing an apparatus that exists there. I don't think there's any reason, and college football and college sports would continue to exist as they are currently, if you let players sell their likenesses.
As we look forward to Thanksgiving, reflect on what we each have to be thankful for. It's also a time of year to remember those who are a lot less fortunate. In the Seattle area, of course, that's impossible not to see with the number of people who are living on the streets. And you may know some of them by name. You may recognize some of them in your neighborhood because you see them all the time, perhaps even selling a Real Change newspaper outside a grocery store. Camilla Walter works with Real Change.
Yeah, this is such an important time of year to think about our neighbors who are living unsheltered. The homelessness crisis is continuing to grow unchecked in Seattle. And at the last point in time count, we had 6,320 people who were sleeping unsheltered outside in our county. This number, for the first time, was more than 50% of the overall homeless population in King County. So as the weather gets colder, more and more people are without shelter in our city. It's a great time to think about how to support our neighbors sleeping outside and giving back.
Real Change was established to give homeless people a way to make a living without begging.
Real Change provides opportunity and a voice for low-income and homeless people while taking action for social, racial, and economic justice. We're a weekly newspaper that is sold by over 300 homeless and low-income people. Our newspaper is award-winning journalism, and it comes out once a week on Wednesdays.
And she wants you to remember that whether you buy Real Change or donate to the Union Gospel Mission or to Mary's Place, this is the season where dozens of organizations depend on you for your donations to sustain them year-round.
It's incredibly dangerous to be sleeping unsheltered, especially as the weather gets colder. As we can't get enough people inside, they're just at risk to the elements and at risk to not getting the correct healthcare access that they need as well.
And sometimes it can be as simple as buying a few extra pair of socks and tossing them into a donation basket.
Absolutely. All of that warm weather gear, hats, socks, gloves, hand warmers and foot warmers, all of those can make a big difference. You can always drop off any donations like that to Real Change or just go out into your neighborhood and talk directly to some of your neighbors who might be in need.
There are so many organizations that do this now. Our church has a giving tree where you take a little ornament off the tree, which is a card that
actually matches
you with a specific person.
I let my daughter choose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Treehouse has, of course, takes donations, and you know, we've raised money for them for years.
And we still are. We still are right on Cairo Radio. Yeah, we're going to be doing Holiday Magic again. It'll be more of the text campaign instead of the radiothon, but you can be listening for that because it's going to launch here soon.
And they have their warehouse where it's just like a store, except no cashier.
Yeah, you've actually visited, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Besides the tutoring, they get kids ready for school, provide them with the backpacks and the clothes. And it's sad to consider that there are kids who just don't have school clothes.
Right, or you take for granted the piano lessons crazy that you got, or paying for the cap and gown, or paying for, you know, music lessons, whatever it may be. You take that for granted growing up. Like, oh, yeah, that opportunity doesn't come to everyone.
Yeah.
So Treehouse does a great job there.
Another group I support is Operation Night Watch, too, which Rick Reynolds runs it. That's where they basically go out every night and try to get to know people who are living on the streets and find out about them. Because as we've discovered, there's no one solution, right? Everybody, you have to find out what situation they're in. And they do what they can to get them to the shelter or to even reunite them with their families, if that's possible.
Yeah, as we found out through the Union Gospel Mission, too, relationships are key. They are more likely to take your offer up of shelter or other services if they know you over an extended period of time. The homeless situation is so political at times, and tensions rise when we talk about what's best or should the shelter be in my neighborhood and all of that. But especially this time of year, the easiest thing you can do, because no matter what, these are still human beings out on the street, right? We can decide if we want something in our neighborhood, if a safe injection site for addicts who might be homeless is the best thing. But overall, these are human beings, and it can be any one of us. And so keeping gloves or socks, which are very coveted, especially socks around this time, in your car, you don't have to give money. You can just give them a pair of socks, and that means just as much as some cash. So there are little things that we can do that if you aren't so sure about the policies or the money being spent on homelessness, what you can be sure of is just keeping somebody's feet warm, the least you can do.
Yeah. Most of the debate revolves around what the government should or shouldn't be doing. But if you know, the easiest way to stop the government getting involved is to make it unnecessary.
Right.
Right. If you have enough organizations that can solve the problem with private donations, then you don't need to get City Hall involved. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Members of that caravan from Central America have reached the southern border. Some have been coming in through the official entryways. Others have been trying to sneak in. And the president said, if you sneak in, even if you're claiming asylum, we're not going to accept your claims. But a federal judge, Ninth Circuit Court, said, I'm sorry, Mr. President, that's not what the law says, and you're going to have to accept them no matter how they come in. Beth Farmer is the director of Refugees Northwest. And Beth, I imagine that you are gratified by this ruling.
We're very, very happy about the ruling. I think lawmakers understood that people fleeing persecution don't always have the safety resources or time to wait at ports of entry. And that's why the process for asylum was passed by Congress in the way that it is right now.
But when you have a large number of, I was going to say huge, but I guess, I mean, we're talking about, I guess, around 4,000 people. So I don't suppose it's a stampede necessarily, but it is a large number of refugees, and they're clearly not equipped to handle them all at once. Isn't that basically like having an open border?
No, I don't think so. An open border would be a process by which you don't attempt to process people in any sort of way. When people come in seeking asylum, they go through an incredibly rigorous process where they have a credible fear interview. They're vetted by USCIS, by immigration. And then if they are not summarily deported, if they are allowed to stay and fight their claim, they are either sent to a detention center, they're ankle monitored, They will have a hearing before a judge. There is a very regulated process.
But is that actually happening? Are there enough agents to interview every one of these people? As I understand it, don't they just either give you the ankle monitor or, you know, give you some kind of a ticket and say, on your way?
No, absolutely not. What is happening right now is they're doing something called metering at the border, and there have been lawsuits against that where they're essentially summarily turning people away or telling them that we're full or even incorrectly telling them that we've met our quota. And so what often happens is that people are stranded on the other side of the border for weeks and sometimes months at a time, sleeping on the street in places like Tijuana and Matamoros that can be very unsafe, especially for children. Every single person that comes in will have a credible fear interview. That happens, and it is a rigorous interview. And unlike some of the things in the press, people don't simply say, I have a credible fear, and they're on their way. No, they are interviewed quite rigorously by people at USCIS, and it's only if they meet that standard do they move on to the next step.
The New York Times article, though, said that in October, there were 23,121 migrants traveling as families who were detained at the border. Do we really have the staff to process that many people in 1 month?
You know, I can't speak to the staffing at the border, and I think how the United States spends its resources at the border is always up for debate. You know, does it put it in processing? Does it put it in judges? Does it put it in the wall? Does it put it in the military and other forms of security? I think that's up for debate. But asylum is part of our domestic law. It's been passed by Congress. It is part of our international law. And everybody I know supports safe borders, supports being vetted, supports having a regulated process. I do. I'm a mother. I want my family to be safe. Mm-hmm. But I do think, because history shows it, that we can protect our border and provide safety at the same time for those fleeing persecution. So how we do that, I think, is up for the debate. Whether we do it or not is not up for debate.
Let me ask you a political question. That is the optics of the caravan. I know that this was certainly used for political purposes before the campaign to try and plant fear in the minds of people as they were deciding how to vote. But also, it is a large group of people. There apparently have been some outbreaks of rock throwing, relatively minor. But I have a feeling that, most people, even those who are understanding of the plight of refugees, do feel a little unsettled at the idea of a large crowd of people approaching the border. So when you see that, how do you deal with it in your own mind?
The last time that we had the conversation about asylum, the last time we had people crossing the border, that there was a big debate around this was during the forced separation of children from their parents. And one of the reasons that was given at that time was they really wanted to discourage people from crossing the border alone because it was so unsafe. These caravans came together because there was safety in numbers. I think anytime you have people fleeing in large numbers, it can be unsettling. And certainly historically it was unsettling when we had boats fleeing Eastern Europe full of people of the Jewish faith who were trying to land on our border. People were unsettled. However, history has shown that when we look back on the times that we turned away desperate people fleeing for safety, we are ashamed as a nation that we let fear get in the way of our ideals and our values as Americans.
And you think that if we turn these people away, history will judge us harshly?
I think that if we turn these people away without even vetting them, without going through the due process that is in both our domestic and international law, we will have violated our own laws. We will have essentially violated the procedures, the processes, and the laws that we've already set up as a nation.
Beth Farmer is the Director of Refugees Northwest. Thank you, Beth.
Oh, thank you.